Okay, so family beach houses, right? You'd think they'd be all about relaxation and good times, but sometimes they turn into, well, legal nightmares.
Yeah, inheritance battles, sibling rivalry, all that fun stuff. And that's what takes us to a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Parker v. Sheckett.
Exactly.
And this case, it really digs into this idea of ouster, when one co-owner basically kicks the others out of a property.
It really does. It's fascinating because, it starts with this kind of ordinary family squabble, but then it ends up setting this major legal precedent for property ownership. Like a reminder that even casual agreements, even unspoken understandings, they can have some serious legal consequences.
Right, so let's set the scene, right? We've got Mary Sheckett, and when she passes away, her estate goes to her three children.
Anne Winfield, who we'll just call Win.
Wynn, yeah. And Marion the Third, or Beau, as we'll call him.
Makes it easier.
Way easier. Now, part of the estate is this beach house, and the will, it actually laid out a plan. But the siblings, they decided to do their own thing, right? They made this informal agreement that Anne and Beau, they jointly own the beach house.
And that's where we hit this key concept in property law, tenants in common. Basically, it means Anne and Beau, each of them, they had an equal right to possess and use that property.
Oh, equal rights.
Yeah. Think of it like, I don't know, sharing a giant pizza, right? Everyone gets a slice. No one can just hog the whole thing.
Right, everyone gets their fair share. But, well, someone decided they wanted the whole pizza in this case.
Oh, yeah, the drama starts.
Because, fast forward to 1996, and Beau decides, you know what? I'm going to make this beach house my main home. And not only that, he changes the locks. So Anne is basically barred from the property. Talk about a family feud, right?
Yeah, big time. And this is exactly what we're talking about, that line between just using shared property, right?
Yeah.
And taking those actions that actually exclude a co-tenant from what they rightfully own.
So Anne's locked out. Naturally, she's not happy about it. What does she do?
Well, she takes action. She sues for partition,
Partition, okay.
which is basically a legal process to divide up property that's jointly owned. But here's where it gets even more interesting.
Okay.
Beau and Win, they countersue,
They fight back.
saying, hey, we were just upholding our agreement, our informal agreement.
So we've got this back and forth. What happens next?
The lower courts, they acknowledge the siblings' agreement, but they don't really see Beau's actions as ouster. They just order the beach house to be sold. So Anne's claim about being shut out, kind of left hanging.
So how does this case, this seemingly straightforward property dispute, how does it end up at the Supreme Court? What makes it so significant?
Yeah, that's the question, right? It probably wasn't the specific details of the case that caught their eye. It was more likely that the lower courts might have messed up this whole idea of ouster. You see, the Supreme Court, they saw this as a chance to really clarify the law, make things clear, and make sure property rights were being protected for co-tenants, like across the board.
Right. So the Supreme Court steps in, and here's the big question they have to grapple with. Did Beau changing those locks and keeping Anne out, did that actually count as ouster? And if it did, was Anne owed something, for being locked out of her own property?
And the Supreme Court came back with a decision that, well, it shook things up in the legal world.
What did they say?
They said, yes, changing locks and denying a co-tenant access, that is ouster, plain and simple.
Wow.
So no consent, it's ouster. This was a huge signal, this idea that being a co-owner comes with responsibilities. You can't just decide on your own to exclude someone from something they rightfully own.
Okay, so a big win for Anne. But how did they get there? I mean, Beau didn't physically evict her. He just changed the locks. How does that qualify as ouster?
Yeah, and that's a great question. It gets to the core of the Supreme Court's reasoning. They emphasize that ouster, it doesn't require like some dramatic scene, someone being physically thrown out.
Right.
It's about the co-tenant's actions. If those actions show they're trying to have exclusive control, trying to deny the other co-tenant their rights, that's enough. It's not about forceful removal. It's about being denied your rightful
So
access.
it's about what you do, not just what you say, and how those actions affect the other owner's ability to actually use their property.
Exactly.
Did the Supreme Court's opinion, did it have any specific wording that really hammered this point home?
Oh, absolutely. They used phrases like when they were describing Beau's actions, they said it was distinctly hostile to Anne's rights.
Ooh, that's pretty strong.
Yeah, it's like changing those locks was Beau's way of saying you're not welcome here.
Right.
The court made it clear that those actions, even without any harsh words, were enough to show his intent was to shut Anne out from the property.
It seems pretty clear-cut now, but it sounds like the lower courts, they really missed the mark. What were their main errors? How did the Supreme Court kind of set them straight?
Well, the lower courts, they seemed really fixated on the lack of, you know, explicitly hostile statements from Beau. They were looking for that smoking gun. Like, did Beau actually say, get out, this is my house now? But the Supreme Court, they took a much more practical approach. They recognized that actions often speak louder than words, right? And in this case, what Beau did, taking over the house for years, changing the locks, that was enough to show he intended to claim the property for himself.
It's fascinating how they focused on the evidence, the actual actions, rather than just words. Mm-hmm. What if Beau had said he was just protecting the property? Like, what if he suspected vandalism and changed the locks for safety reasons? Would that have been a valid defense?
That's a common argument, but the Supreme Court, they shut it down. They made it clear. Self-help remedies, things like changing locks without permission, they're not okay in these situations. If Beau was genuinely worried about damage, the right way to go about it would have been to seek an injunction or some other kind of court intervention. You can't just bypass the legal system, even if you think you're doing the right thing.
So there's a process for a reason. This case feels like it's full of lessons for lawyers and law students. What are some key takeaways from Parker v. Sheckett that legal professionals should really keep in mind, especially when they're advising clients about shared property ownership?
You're absolutely right. This case, it's like a masterclass in property law. One of the biggest takeaways, tell your clients to put any agreements about property access in writing. Vague arrangements, especially with family involved, can turn into huge headaches.
Right. Leaving things open to interpretation. It's almost like asking for a legal battle, especially when you add in family dynamics and maybe some simmering resentments. Are there any other lessons lawyers should take away from this?
Absolutely. Another crucial point, hostility. It can be inferred from what a co-tenant does, not just from what they say. So document everything, interactions, decisions, anything related to that shared property. Because if a dispute does come up, having a clear record, that can be the key to proving ouster.
So it's about the actions, how they impact the other co-tenant's property rights. It seems like this case isn't just about clarifying ouster. It's also reinforcing a broader principle about protecting those property rights.
Exactly. This case sends a message. Courts need to actively protect property rights, even against informal attempts to push someone out. The Supreme Court's decision in Parker v. Sheckett, it basically tells us you can't just sidestep the legal system and exclude someone from what they rightfully own, no matter what your intentions are.
Right. It's like the court is saying, if you want to change the rules, you have to do it the right way, not by locking someone out.
Precisely. And this leads to another critical point. Understanding legal remedies. A co-tenant who's been ousted, they can not only try to get back onto the property, but can also claim damages for the time they were denied their rightful use and enjoyment.
So there are real consequences for the person who does the ousting. It's like saying, not only do I get my property back, but I also get compensated for the time I was unfairly kept out. It sounds like the Supreme Court really wanted to ensure that Anne received justice, not just in principle, but also in terms of tangible compensation.
Absolutely. The court didn't just say ouster happened. They sent the case back to the lower court to figure out exactly how much Anne was owed for all those years she couldn't access the beach house. This highlights how important it is to get legal counsel and pursue every available remedy in these situations.
It seems like Parker v. Sheckett is packed with valuable insights, not just for lawyers, but for anyone dealing with shared property. Know your rights, document everything, and don't be afraid to seek legal help if you need it. But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, there's one more piece of this case that I think we should look at, a detail that might not be obvious at first glance, but has some big implications for how we understand Parker v. Sheckett and its potential reach.
You got it. And it's a detail that could actually change how we think about shared ownership in general.
Ooh, okay, now I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Well, you'll have to wait until the next part of our deep dive. We'll uncover it all then. Welcome back. Before we took that break, we were talking about how the Supreme Court really emphasized actions over words when it came to determining ouster. Remember that bright line rule?
Mm-hmm.
Changing the locks on a property that's jointly owned? That's ouster, end of story. But there's this fascinating little detail, something that could have way bigger implications than you might think.
You really had me hanging there. You mentioned this detail could actually change how we think about shared ownership. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, let's think about the kind of property we're dealing with in Parker v. Sheckett, right? A beach house, a tangible piece of real estate. But what if, just what if, we take the principles of this case and apply them to other types of shared property. Think about intangible assets like digital property, intellectual property rights, or even, you know, financial assets that are jointly held.
Okay, now that's interesting. Could changing the password to a shared online account,
yeah,
could that be seen as ouster in the digital world? Or what about like removing someone's name from the copyright of something they helped create? Are those actions similar to changing the locks on a beach house?
Yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head. The legal principles that came out of Parker v. Schuckett, even though they came from a real estate dispute, they could potentially stretch way beyond that to all kinds of shared ownership scenarios. And that's where things get really exciting, not just for lawyers, but for anyone who shares ownership of anything in today's world.
So you're saying that just changing a password or blocking someone from a shared online platform that could have similar legal consequences to physically locking someone out of a house? That seems like a pretty big leap.
It's a thought-provoking idea, for sure, and one that's getting a lot of attention in legal circles. The core idea of Parker v. Schuckett is about protecting the rights of those co-owners and making sure one person can't just unfairly shut out another. The specific actions, they might change depending on what kind of property we're talking about, but the underlying logic, the legal logic, it could apply across the board.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting for me. Imagine what this could mean for digital assets and online collaboration. If changing a password can be seen as ouster, it could totally revolutionize how we think about ownership and control in the digital age.
Exactly. Think about businesses that are entirely online, creative partnerships that exist only digitally, or even families sharing cloud storage or financial accounts. The principles from Parker v. Schuckett could completely change how we deal with disputes and conflicts in these situations, which are becoming more and more common.
It's almost like this case, even though it came from a traditional property dispute, it's opened up a whole can of worms when it comes to legal questions about the digital age.
Mm.
It's like the court, without meaning to, gave us a framework for understanding ownership and ouster in a world that's moving beyond physical boundaries.
You've got it. And that's what makes Parker v. Schuckett so fascinating. It's not just about who won or lost. It's about the bigger picture and how it might change legal thinking as we try to figure out this whole idea of shared ownership in the 21st century.
This is why I love these deep dives. You find these hidden layers of meaning and connect ideas that seem totally unrelated. And you're like, whoa, I never thought about it that way before.
I know, right? It's all about that aha moment when you realize one single case can have effects that ripple out way beyond its original context. And with Parker v. Schuckett, those ripples, they might even reach the very foundation of how we define and regulate ownership in a world that's so focused on digital connections.
So what does this mean for our listeners? We've looked at the legal precedents, how this applies to lawyers in practice, and even the bigger impact on society. What's the one key takeaway you want them to remember about Parker v. Schuckett?
I think the most important thing to remember is this. The idea of ouster, the way this case clarified it, it goes beyond just being physically kept out of a property. It's about recognizing and protecting the rights of co-owners no matter what, whether it's a tangible piece of property or something intangible, like a digital asset or intellectual property. The specific details might change, technology might evolve, but the fundamental principle stays the same. Co-ownership comes with responsibilities, and you can't just act on your own to deny another person their right to access and benefit from what they own.
That's a powerful message, and one that goes beyond the specifics of this case. It highlights how the law, even though it's often based on historical precedents, has to adapt and evolve to keep up with the changing world. And Parker v. Schuckett, even though it started with a seemingly simple fight over a beach house, could be a driving force for that evolution, pushing us to rethink what ownership means in a world that's more and more interconnected and intangible.
Couldn't have said it better myself. This case, it's so much more than just a footnote in legal history. It's like a signpost pointing us toward a future where the whole idea of ownership itself might have to be redefined as we try to navigate the complexities of shared assets, digital spaces, and the lines between the physical and virtual worlds becoming blurrier and blurrier.
You've given us a lot to think about, and I feel like this is just the beginning of the conversation. As technology keeps advancing and new forms of property emerge, I bet the principles of Parker v. Schuckett will be debated, analyzed, and reinterpreted for years to come. This case is definitely going to leave its mark.
Absolutely. We're just scratching the surface here. I'm sure we'll come back to these themes in future episodes as we explore new frontiers in property law and the challenges of shared ownership in our rapidly changing world.
I'm looking forward to it. But for now, we've covered a lot of ground, dug into the nuances of ouster, and even ventured into uncharted territory with digital property rights. Let's do a quick recap before we wrap up this part of our deep dive.
Sounds good. Let's take a moment to put together the key takeaways from Parker v. Shusickit and what it means for lawyers, co-owners, and anyone trying to make sense of shared assets in today's world.
Right, because this isn't just a fascinating legal story. It's a case with real-world implications that could affect anyone who shares ownership of something, whether it's a family vacation home or a collaborative online project. We'll be right back to break down the essence of Parker v. Shusickit and leave you with some food for thought. And we're back with the deep dive. We've been really digging into this whole Parker v. Shusickit case, you know, the one that started as a fight over a beach house but ended up clarifying this super important property law principle, and it goes way beyond just a family squabble. But let's take a minute, kind of crystallize everything we've learned, pull out the key takeaways.
That's a great idea. It's all about understanding and applying what we've learned. So let's recap the essence of Parker v. Shusickit and what it means for our listeners, whether they're lawyers dealing with shared property or just love a good legal story.
Exactly. So back to the beginning, we had Mary Shusickit leaving that beach house to two of her kids, Ann and Beau, as tenants in common, equal rights to use and enjoy the place. But then Beau moves in, changes the locks, shuts Ann out. Sibling rivalry gone wrong, right?
Yep. Classic case. And that's where ouster comes in. The lower courts, they didn't initially see Beau's actions as ghoster, but the Supreme Court stepped in and was like, wait a minute, this is textbook ouster. They made it super clear. Changing locks, denying a co-tenant access, even without threats or anything, that's a big no-no. And that's where that bright line rule we talked about comes from, a clear standard for when a co-owner crosses the line.
And it wasn't just about winning a legal argument. It was about protecting Anne's rights to her property, making sure she was compensated for being unfairly excluded. The Supreme Court didn't just say, yep, ouster happened. They sent the case back down to figure out exactly how much Anne was owed for all those years she couldn't use her own property.
That's right. This case really highlights that property rights aren't just some abstract idea. They have real-world consequences. And when those rights are violated, the courts need to step in and provide a remedy. That's a powerful takeaway for anyone dealing with shared ownership, whether it's a family home, a business, even an online platform.
So what's the big takeaway, the one thing we want our listeners to remember from all of this?
For legal professionals, it's a big reminder to always, always advise clients about having clear written agreements when it comes to shared property. Ambiguity, informal agreements, they can lead to some really messy disputes, especially with families. And document everything, too. Interactions, decisions, any actions related to the property. If a dispute does come up, having that clear record can be what wins the case.
Right, because leaving things open to interpretation, it's like setting yourself up for a legal battle, especially with family dynamics and maybe some simmering resentment in the mix. And for anyone who's sharing ownership of anything, it's crucial to know your rights and responsibilities. What is ouster? What can you do if you're wrongfully excluded? Don't be afraid to get legal advice if you're not sure how to navigate all of this.
Definitely. Knowledge is power. And in property law, knowing your rights can make all the difference between getting taken advantage of and actually protecting your interests.
But we went even further, didn't we? We talked about how the principles from Parker v. Shusickit could go beyond traditional real estate into the digital world, things like digital assets, intellectual property, all those forms of shared ownership online.
We sure did. And that's where things get super interesting. While Parker v. Shusickit was about a physical property, those core principles, protecting co-owners' rights, stopping unjust exclusion, they could apply to so many other situations, like changing a password to a shared account online or taking someone's name off a joint copyright. Could those be seen as ouster in the digital world?
It's pretty mind-blowing to think about. It really shows how the law has to adapt to keep up with how fast the world is changing. And Parker v. Shusickit, even though it came from this simple beach house dispute, it might end up being what makes us rethink how we define and protect ownership in this digital age.
It definitely makes you question what property even means anymore in a time when we have all these intangible assets and online collaborations. How do you balance individual rights with the need to make decisions efficiently in these new digital contexts? Those are tough questions, ones we'll probably be grappling with for years to come.
That's why Parker v. Shusickit is so much more than just a legal story. It makes you think critically about how ownership is changing, what the boundaries are for co-ownership, and how the law has to change to keep up and protect those rights in this increasingly complex and interconnected world.
It shows us how even a simple property dispute can have these huge ripple effects and start a bigger conversation about some pretty fundamental legal concepts.
And as always, we encourage our listeners to keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep into the world of law. This has been The Deep Dive, exploring all the ins and outs of Parker v. Sheckett and its lasting impact on property law. Until next time, stay curious.